Those of you who listen to us regularly know that I'm not a big fan of Levanses or any such thing. To me, this should be a day when we all remember that the happy encounters with progress over the past 15 years have not resulted in what was promised. Remember in the 90s, everybody was going to look forward to a 30-day work week with almost full employment, with remarkable salaries and wages. Hasn't worked out that way. And all we keep hearing from a national population, and I dare say a continental population, is what does labor want? Well, they want more. And they should. More schools and less jails, more books and less arsenals, more learning and less vice, more leisure and less greed, more justice and less revenge. The labor of a human being is not a commodity. You can't weigh the soul of man with a bar of pig iron. I didn't say that. A little cigar maker around the turn of the last century named Samuel Gompers said it, and he went on to found the American Federation of Labor. And to those of you who think that industrial unionism has seen its day, should open your eyes and ears to some realities in this country and indeed in North America. 75 years after the Great Depression, when 20% of Canadians controlled 80% of the wealth, we have, after the New Deal, the Fair Deal, the Just Society, and the Great Society, 4% of Canadians controlling the same 80%. 5% of our population have a net worth of over $5,000. It's been the greatest concentration of wealth in the G7, second only to Russia in the G8. Yet we have a society that's been fed program after program, and for $24 more on a government check will sell their soul instead of demanding what they should have. We live through wage controls and price controls. For my money, I think of profit controls. There's got to be a more civilized way to do this. And though many people in the labor movement have forgotten what labor should want, our first guest hasn't. Buzz Hargrove, president of the Canadian Auto Workers, has represented his men with distinction and dignity and integrity. And we hope you continue to do that for a long time more, Buzz.
Thank you very much. You're very kind, Bill. I appreciate that.
What should labor want if we hear all the arguments against industrial unionism, if not what Samuel Gompers said a century ago? And if that is still true, what does it say about where we've come?
Well, our problem today is globalization and the ills of that. It's, as you have very, very well pointed out, it's led to more concentration of wealth in fewer hands. It's undermined the ability of working people to make progress on their issues. We live in a time when there's more wealth produced than any other time in the history of humankind. People, the underprivileged, are being convinced that somehow we must take less, while the wealthy, powerful elites who already have too much continue to take more. So we have to challenge that. What do we want? We want fairness. We want an opportunity for people. We don't want handouts and giveaways for people. We want support for those that can't support themselves, but opportunities and jobs. And one of the issues we face today is trade. The unfair trade relationship we have, and I could give you a dozen examples, but I'll use the most major one. That's the auto industry, where everything we build in North America is sold in North America. Everything the Japanese and the South Koreans build is sold in their country. The market's closed. No, consumers have no other choice except their products. And then they ship 40% of their production into Canada and the United States.
So we can't sell there, but they can sell here.
Yeah, that's wild. While they're closing plants and downsizing and laying people off, they're opening new plants and hiring people, and the plants are all built right on the ocean with the ships there so they can build them and put them on the ship to sell. That has to stop or we're going to lose more jobs, and it undermines the fabric of the society, our ability to pay for health care, education, etc.
Why don't the same principles that apply to anti-dumping laws apply in the auto industry?
It's absolutely fascinating to me. We have raised this. Well, you've heard me rant
yes,
on this. I've given speeches. In the last 4 days, I've given at least 3 speeches dealing with this issue. I'm trying to get a meeting with Mr. Harper. We had Mr. Martin moving on the issue, agreeing to bring in a national automotive strategy. But now, since Mr. Harper's been elected, he refuses even to meet with our union to listen logic.
On that issue, and we just got to take a break to pay some bills of our own here, I want to bring you back to the Martin period, and I want to bring you back to the problem of China and how Canadians are subsidizing the loss of their own jobs. And we'll be right back with Buzz Hargrove right after this. And we're talking about labor, what it sure should be. Special guest Hargrove, president of the Canuckers. For the break, we were talking about jobs and Canadian jobs and what each administration is doing. And one thing that has driven me crazy, and call me simple and stupid, but I don't get it. Back in the 70s, we changed the point system, and we were importing cheap labor from anywhere in the world. When that labor rose after 20 years to decent levels, we had pressure on the Liberal government to start shipping jobs out to China. Half of those jobs and half of what China reinvested in Canada was subsidized by the taxpayer with EDC credits. Last year alone, we lost 40,000 textile jobs in Quebec. And Industry Minister Emerson, all he had to say was, well, you know, the textile industry has to reinvent itself. How can any government justify the loss of jobs on this kind of a scale simply to satisfy big business demand for cheap labor?
They can't. They can't. The tragedy of it all is you can't get people focused on demanding and challenging the government. You know, wherever I go, as I said, I've made 3 speeches in the last 4 days dealing with these issues around Labor Day, and an incredible response from people. They understand it, but people just aren't challenging the government enough. They're letting the government get away, quite frankly, with catering to the business community at the expense, not just of working people, but the underprivileged, and the strength of our communities is undermined by these things that are happening. And until we come to grips with that, we should be more like the Americans. They preach and they sign free trade agreements, and then they defend their industry. They don't give a damn about the free trade agreement, as we saw in softwood lumber. They said, we don't care if you're more competitive. You're only going to get a certain percentage of the market, and that's it. So why don't Canadian government and provincial government stand up for Canadians in that manner?
Well, Buzz, you've made a very good point, but the question is it a bottoms-up process from the workers or a top-down process from the leadership? I remember 18 months ago, and you do very well as well, in Quebec, when the Premier of Quebec tried to change Section 45 of the Labor Code, basically to make Quebec a right-to-work state, and I helped out with a few of the small union locals getting people in the streets, and I remember that the union presidents affiliated with the FTQ were really scared that the workers wouldn't get it and they wouldn't get the turnout. And they got 1.3 million Quebecers in the streets of Montreal and Quebec City.
Yeah. Unbelievable, yeah.
So where does the impetus have to come from?
Well, the onus is on the leadership to lead, but we've had more demonstrations over the trade issue. We've had campaigns. We've had material going out on a constant, regular basis across Canada. Let's use the example. In Ontario, you can get some ahead of steam. Therefore, Harper doesn't elect many people. The Liberals were listening and saying, we're willing to do something. We want money, as opposed to the free trade that gives all our jobs away. But it's pretty hard in an industry like auto to say to Quebecers, you should join with us, when the only assembly plant they hadn't come.
Yep.
And then the same as British Columbia. How do you get them excited about an auto industry?
And in the auto industry, you're pretty well organized up to the limit. It's not like some other industries where organization work is still to be done. Let me ask you a last question. When you're facing shutdowns like GM in Quebec, the Ford cutbacks, is there an argument to be made in Canada, because of AutoPac, because of the flood of Asian cars, is there an argument to be made that, look, we've had wage and price controls, what's wrong with some profit limits to keep tens of thousands of jobs? We're not talking about 100 or 200 or 500 jobs. Is that a legitimate argument today, or is that beyond the pale already?
No, it's a legitimate argument in some industries under some circumstances, but right now our problem is we wish General Motors and Ford were making a lot of money so we could talk to them about reinvesting in clean jobs. Our problem is, in perspective, that Ford lost over $2 billion in the first 6 months of this year. Toyota made $2.3 billion in profit. So Toyota's, their strategy of keeping their market closed, shipping into Canada, not allowing us to sell there, shipping in the United States, not allowing the Americans to sell there, is working. So we have to come to grips with the trade issue. If not, it's like textiles. We've lost so many jobs. It's like electrical, electronics. We've lost televisions. We've lost all of these jobs to other countries. So we need a government that's more sensitive to Canadian working people.
Buzz Hargrove, with labor leaders like you, will keep that issue front and center, and I want to congratulate you on your recent re-election and your upcoming marriage.
Oh, great. Thank you very much.
Let both terms of office go smoothly.
Okay, I sure hope so.
Buzz,
sure
thanks very much for taking the time.
All the best. Happy Labor Day.
Take care. You too. Bob Lakely. Bob Lakely is one of the finest minds in the labor movement, and I don't mean just in terms of being a labor leader, but understanding where labor fits into the big picture. And he's a Canadian director for the National Building Trades and Construction Council, affiliated with the AFL-CIO and the Canadian Labor Congress. Bob, thanks for joining us from Edmonton today. Thanks for taking time out from the weekend.
Thank you very much, and happy Labor Day. This is one of the few days that we get to celebrate because we've actually earned it as opposed to somebody just giving it to us.
Bob, you know me. If you didn't hear my intro, you know that I'm an old curmudgeon. I don't like any life cycle events, but I think this day, Labor Day, should be every day, and workers should remember and understand whether they're getting screwed or not. Now, you may have heard Buzz Hargrove just now talk about the impact of what is basically dumping into the Canadian market and restrictions on the Canadian market, and we talked about the loss of Canadian jobs in manufacturing to China simply to give cheap labor to big business. How does the construction industry protect itself? You haven't got exactly the same problems, but you still have problems of organization in certain jurisdictions where there's not enough being done there.
Yes and no. Do we have a problem with foreign workers? Yes. They're not moving the construction job to China. However, there are a number of owners who go out and say, we can't find a Canadian who will work for the terms that we're prepared to pay, which is code for we can't find Canucks stupid enough to work for really cheap. So we want to get foreign workers to come in and fill the ranks, build our projects, and they'll just go back to China or Romania or wherever it is they can happen to.
Well, let me ask you about that, and it's in your backyard. You're in Edmonton, and we're hearing about the oil patch in Fort McMurray, and just last week the story came out that they're looking for workers who are prepared to work at their wage levels, at their wage levels. Now, the Canadian Petroleum Association, the minutes of its last meeting said that even a barrel of tar sands, of heavy crude, they're making $3 profit at $20 a barrel. It costs them $17 in labor and production to get a barrel of oil out. Oil's at $73. How come we don't have tax credits from the government, and we didn't have it through 12 years of Liberal Party rule, who just allowed, you know, the tar sands to be exploited like a land development? How come we don't have tax credits from the federal government that subsidize people in those jobs and companies to take on Canadian workers instead of going offshore and looking for workers, as the Canadian Petroleum Association said recently, in everywhere from Romania to China? And I want you to answer that question, if you would, after this break, where we got to make some money, I'm being told, because they're coming at me with knives. Oh, the knives in the eyes, Blakely. We'll be right back with Bob Blakely.
Righto.
We're talking about the place of labor in our society today. As most of you know, my opinion, labor needs to be more. And with us now is one of the best minds in organized labor, Bob Blakely of the National Building and Construction Trades Council, AFL-CIO-CLC. Bob, we were talking before the break. Is organization a major issue now in construction trades? We see that Quebec, you've got the construction industry almost at 100%, but those percentages go down when you get out of Quebec.
It's a really significant challenge for the construction unions. Basically, our numbers have been stagnant since the 1980s. Unfortunately for us, the industry's growing by a huge amount. I mean, the size of the industry has more than doubled, and we've stayed running in the glue. We've done the big jobs, and we've done our niche projects, but we haven't grown with the industry, and that's part of the reason, I guess, that people are saying, let's import a workforce from somewhere.
Well, you know, talking about importing workforces, we know there's been an issue on the table since the late 90s, and the former government promised a solution to it. There was a draft document that was ready for signature, was never signed.
Yeah.
We know that the Department of Public Works itself employs, in the National Capital Region, has employed some years as much as 16,000 not only non-unionized workers, but many of them aren't even Canadians.
Yes.
So how long do we let this problem continue?
I don't know. I mean, if you look at the federal government, except for the dockyards on each of the coasts, the Navy dockyards, the government doesn't train apprentices. They have a huge number of tradespeople. They fund the apprenticeship programs across the country, but when it comes time for someone to bid on the work, they allow anybody to bid on the work. You don't have to supply qualified, competent people. You don't have to have an apprenticeship program. I can't imagine a more self-defeating strategy than that.
Is it legitimate to say, to demand from governments at all levels that, hey, you are, in order to protect the quality of life in Canada, you are going to hire Canadians and you're going to hire unionized workers? Is that legitimate?
I think it's, well, from my perspective, the answer is yes. Hire Canadians, yes. Hire unionized. If you hire the union, you get the health and safety, you get the dignity in retirement, you get the pension, you get all those other social benefits that most people will tell you are appropriate, and most of all, you get the apprenticeship program that we force down the throats of the employers.
As you know, we've talked often on this subject, and you know that my work in with unions has dealt with industrial unions, and I'm a big believer in industrial unionism, that is those unions that represent workers in industries like auto, in construction. I have less experience and perhaps even less sympathy in certain other unions, let's call them professional unions. But I think we have to take a look at what happened in the States at the last AFL-CIO convention in Chicago, where Andy Stern, who heads up one of the largest growing unions, and that union represents government employees, led six unions out of the AFL-CIO, and his big complaint was lack of organization, we're not getting on the ground anymore, and you're not seeing the future of labor. Now, if that rift continues, what is the future of labor, which has traditionally drawn its strength from the big tent?
You know, that is a $64,000 question. Unions, I think, are at an extremely vital crossroads at this time. If you look at what's going on in the United States, the fragmentation of the labor movement, and if someone were to say to me, take a crystal ball and try and figure out what's going to happen here in Canada, I think there's a number of people who are going to say a plague on all your houses, and they're going to try and figure out a way to fix the problem here at home.
Meaning what?
Meaning you'll see a lot more groups which don't rely on an international organization, be it an industrial union, a construction union, or a government union. They will try and build their own organization at home.
At the local level.
If that organization is going to do something for them. The truth of the matter is the fragmentation of unions into small groups like that will have the same debilitating effect on unions that fragmentation of industries have for owners and employers.
Are we going to, you're painting a situation, and I don't mean to put words in your mouth, but where on the one hand we have industrial globalization among corporations, on the other hand we have the shattering of the industrial international unions into small groups that are prey to the global power of the large corporations. Is that where we're heading? Is that the picture that's being painted?
Well, that's that's a navel gaze, sitting down at the crystal ball and saying, if people don't get on with the business of organizing, I think that's a very real potential outcome. And I think that is, for the labor movement, that could be a potentially fatal one.
And that's brass tacks, what unionism is about, is the organization. Bob Blakely, thanks very much for taking the time to be with us today.
Thanks, Pearl. Happy Labor Day.
Have a good rest of the weekend. Montreal will be right back after the news. So a young school on a street in Outremont. The school building, a story and a half high, nothing recommended, certainly nothing that anybody can be jealous of. It's certainly not a monument to anything other than to learning and hopefully tolerance. He pulls a mask over his head and raises a Molotov cocktail to throw into a window. A window that 15 minutes earlier had 20 children in the room, realizes that there's no one in the room, realizes that the window has a screen, turns away from disgust, walks several feet to his left, to his right, sorry, and throws the Molotov cocktail into the entrance and engulfs that part of the building in flames. That's what happened in this city over this weekend. Police are saying, well, it's not a hate crime. The school was a religious Jewish day school. Police say it's not a hate crime because they didn't find a note. One presumes that they want to keep tempers at an even level, but I certainly hope that the next time there's a murder, they don't disqualify it as a murder just because somebody didn't leave a note. The tragedy of all this is that some 18 months after the firebombing of the Talmud Torah school in Saint Laurent, this kind of event was bound to happen. We have lived through 30 days of Quebec media and political leadership spouting words of interposition and nullification. And they claim that it has to do with Israel, but it doesn't. These are code words. You can't have a society without, that doesn't explode in 100 little ways like this when you have radio talk show hosts using words like les Juifs instead of les Israéliens when talking about the Middle East crisis, when you have political leaders that sign manifestos for rallies that specifically exclude Jewish participation or peace for Israel and talk about only Lebanon and Palestine. You cannot avoid this kind of tragedy when for the sake of pandering for votes and trade union memberships, you have union leaders in Quebec and federal politicians in Quebec that normally detest each other coming out and talking about vicious slaughter on the part of Israel in the recent conflict, and having that followed up by media hosts talking about Israel as modern-day Nazis. This is the mentality of a failed society. Mark Twain once said, anti-Semitism is the swollen meanness, injustice, and envy of pygmy minds. And I'm afraid that this virus of pygmy minds is beginning to infect Quebec. And hopefully here to prove me a bit wrong is Sid Stevens, founder and director of Sun Youth, that has offered a $5,000 reward for information leading to this fellow that was caught on videotape on this firebombing. Sid, tell me I'm wrong. Give me some hope.
Well, first of all, I want to correct you on one aspect. The reward of $5,000 has been offered by a French businessman.
Yes, I'm sorry,
Canadian
you mentioned that. Correct, yes.
Okay, and he's entrusted Sun Youth Organization to hold on to the reward to make it available, which we did today.
And he's the same gentleman who wished to remain anonymous who offered a $15,000 reward at the time of the Talmud Torah bombing.
Exactly, and what we did at the time, because that was very good police work, they were able to resolve that on their own. He asked us to make sure that we put ads in the various newspapers regarding the reward, so in reality he gave it to us and we spent it in a different direction. I could tell you that my experience, and I've been in the business for 52 years, I have never seen so much hate, and I've never seen so much concern, as well as the people really being upset, because as you indicated earlier, there were in 18 months, we've had the United Talmud Torahs, and now we had this incident, which they call a firebombing. They don't want to call it a hate crime. They are calling it arson. But I could tell you that we received six or seven calls from a lot of people. A lot of, you know, we get an aging population in Quebec. One of every four
yes.
Quebecers is a senior, and a lot have indicated the fact to us that they're very concerned. This reminds them of what happened in Kristallnacht during the Holocaust in 1938 in Germany, and a lot of these people who lived through it are terrified. And we've seen and heard and witnessed the calls coming in here in the last 24 hours from an aging population who's very, very concerned, who's lived through this.
Sid, we've got to take a short break here. I want to come back to something you said in the papers today that is very troubling, and coming from you, you have a voice of singular authenticity, and I want to get into it. Montreal, I'll be right back. And we're talking about the current culture of intolerance that reared its this past weekend with the firebombing of the Toldot Yaakov. And we're talking with Sid Stevens, director of Sun Youth, who is a trusted $1,000 reward offered by a Francophone Montrealer who wishes to remain anonymous, the same man who put up a $15,000 reward at the time of the Talmud Torah bombings. Sid, you had made a comment to the Gazette that You haven't seen it this bad since the days following the Second World War. Which part? The general culture in Montreal or the fear in certain aspects of the Montreal community?
No, what I was referring to to, after the Saint Laurent incident, this to me is the second most worrisome incident of this nature. I haven't seen, as I indicated earlier, anything very close to this going back to the Second World War. What I was referring to was the fact of the hate that I've seen being registered. And also, B'nai B'rith also indicated that there are anti-Semitic incidents in Canada registered with B'nai B'rith has tripled since the start of the hostilities in the Middle East.
Yep.
And we have noticed that by the amount of calls that we've received of hostility towards the Jewish community, I have not seen in a long time. And the witness is the fact of the increase of graffiti, swastika markings on synagogues, on walls, on monuments. It's really escalated in comparison to previous years.
Well, you've made a perfect segue, and I want you to stay on the line as we welcome Leah Berger, Director of Government Relations and Public Affairs for B'nai B'rith Quebec. Leah, I know that Sid and I can talk about this more freely. You've got a different imperative. How is B'nai B'rith approaching this?
Well, certainly we've reacted with great concern. We regard this incident as a dangerous and despicable act of violence and as a hate crime.
Now, why do you think that the police so quickly came out and said this is, we have not categorized it yet as a hate crime?
Well, this is something that we face on an ongoing basis. Police and law enforcement have a different perspective on the definition of a hate crime. For us, the fact that it was the incident was targeted at a Jewish school speaks for itself. This is a crime against the Jewish community.
Your B'nai B'rith's well-known audit of anti-Semitic incidents, I don't know if it's done on a trailing basis or on an annual basis, but in reference to what Sid Stevens just said, have you seen any monitoring? Have you seen any blips up in the past few months, particularly since the extreme language that we've seen in Quebec since the pro-Hezbollah rally on August the 6th and since the start of hostilities in the Middle East?
Well, I'd certainly say that while this latest incident this weekend has drawn the attention of the media and the community, that we've recorded a surge in anti-Semitic incidents since mid-July. In fact, a comparison of the number of incidents recorded through our anti-hate hotline in July 2006 in comparison with incidents in July 2005 indicate, as you said, that the number of incidents have tripled.
Sid, the police, you work a lot with community organizations and you work a lot on the street and you've got a lot of street info. Do you work closely with the police on incidents like this? Do they come to you and say, look, what you hear, pass on?
Yes, I could tell you, we work very close. We have a very close working relationship with the anti-gang squad, with various squads, major crimes. And I could tell you that I can relate to the incident that happened in United Tom and Torah. I've seen the police work very, very close with B'nai B'rith, with Sun Youth Organization in close cooperation. And I can tell you in this dossier, even though it's the arson squad that's investing in it, the case of the present time, they are working very, very close. They really are doing everything they possibly can. I see them shifting through garbage this morning at the school. They've got all kinds of additional personnel that have been added. They want to solve this as quickly as possible. And they're very, very determined. But I can tell you that they're working very closely with various organizations to try and resolve it as well.
Leah Berger, you were at the scene quite soon after it happened. How extensive was the damage?
Well, what you could see from the doors, the windows were all broken and at that point had been boarded up with planks of wood. But on the interior, in the vestibule where the Molotov cocktail had actually exploded, the wall was completely charred. And so it must have been terribly traumatic for the students who returned to school on Sunday to have to walk through that and see an absolutely charred wall and boarded up windows.
To either of you, the first clip we're seeing of the firebomber wanting to throw the Molotov cocktail through a window and then he stops in what seems to be aggravation, was that because the window was screened off or because there were no kids in the room who were there 20 minutes earlier?
Supposedly, according to what the police had indicated, that's because there was a screen there.
Leah, did you see that screen?
Well, what I had heard was that he was concerned that the bomb would then bounce back at him.
Yeah, but you were there on the scene. Did you see the screen in the window?
No, I mean, at that point, it had all been boarded up.
So that part also, even though that's part of the classroom?
Yes. Yes, that was part of a classroom. They had 20 minutes earlier, they had about 20 students there.
Again, to either of you, how differently do the Montreal police approach an investigation when they decided at the beginning that it's a hate crime? And how differently is it approached when they decided strictly arson? And secondarily, is the reason they're playing this down, could it be that they actually have the hate crime unit out there, but they just, you know, want to temper everybody's passions?
Well, I would agree with Mr. Stevens' assessment in the sense that I think police are really working hard to, in terms of trying to find the perpetrator. But, I mean, even in going back to the United Talmud Torah case, despite the fact that Sleeman Elmer Hebby left a note at the scene and it quite clearly indicated his motivation in terms of revenge for the assassination of Sheikh Yassin, they were still reluctant at that time to classify it as a hate crime.
But, you know, it's not carved in stone. If they feel, the arson squad doing their investigation feel that they do believe it is a hate crime, it could be switched to the unit that will handle it as well. But I could tell you from my experience, you couldn't have a better group of police officers in the arson squad investigating it because they're very, very thorough. Not that other departments aren't, but they're very, very thorough. And if they feel for some reason that it should be transferred or classified as a hate crime, they certainly will do it because it's not carved in stone that they can't do it and won't do it. This is the preliminary stage, okay, of the investigation at this time. We have to be patient, so we have to give them time.
Sid, Leah, please stay with us for just through this short break. I want to ask you guys one final question that I think is on everybody's mind today. We'll be right back. And you can email CA. We're talking to Sid Stevens of Sun Youth, Leah Berger, Director of Government Relations, B'nai B'rith, Quebec. Sid, Leah, thanks for staying on. I've got one final question for both of you. How much of what happened... No, let me rephrase that. Can we expect more because of the kind of vituperative and vitriolic language we've heard in Quebec due to the Middle East crisis in the past month?
I would like to say no, but I think we can anticipate there will be more incidents. This will not be the last one, unfortunately. That's my opinion.
I agree. Leah Berger?
Well, I think if you look at the number of anti-Semitic incidents over the longer term, say over the last 10 years, you know, in the 1990s, we were seeing total number of incidents across Canada in the 200s, 300s, and now we're seeing, in fact, in 2005, we had 829, which is the second highest number of incidents in the 23-year history of the audit. So just looking at that, I unfortunately don't think that things will decline.
Leah Berger, Sid Stevens, thanks very much.
It's my pleasure.
Take care.
Good evening.
And that question that I just posed to Leah Berger and Sid Stevens is, to my mind, at the root of all this. What happened in the way Quebec reacted to Israel during the Middle East crisis, if it didn't border on almost societal incitement, then it came very close. You cannot have a population hearing an intelligentsia, a media, constantly referring to the one free nation in that part of the world as Nazis or the Jews without it impacting in that society. And you didn't hear this anywhere else. So let's not hear any apology for this. We're going to spend most of the next hour talking with two very special guests who are in studio, and we're going to see if things might have been different, if things might have been different. It's our pleasure to welcome former Israeli Ambassador Freddy Eitan, the author of a new biography of Ariel Sharon, A Life in Times of Turmoil, and the book's publisher, Robert Davies, Studio 9 Books, who's been a very successful publisher on the Canadian scene. And we're going to talk to Ambassador Eitan about what things might have been, and we're going to talk to Robert Davies about how Montreal Publishing House competes. Welcome, Ambassador Eitan. Welcome, Robert Davies.
Thank you, Beryl. Nice to be here.
Quick question, which you're going to expound upon, Ambassador Eitan, and you're going to expound upon it after the break. Would things have been different in the Middle East if Ariel Sharon still led? And if they would have been different, how different?
It will be. I think that Ariel Sharon, as a leader, as a charismatic, as his policy for peace and tranquility in the Middle East, will be changed, the Middle East, because his decision, his determination to approach the Israeli conflict with the Palestinian, but also with the Lebanese, with the Hezbollah, will be changed the arena of the Middle East. We know that today we have a crisis of leadership. It is not the same Israel after the war in Lebanon. We are very disappointed about this decision of our government
Forgive me for interrupting, because we can come back to this after the break, but it is on that point that I'm asking you the question. Much of the criticism that went completely over the top on Israel started out as focusing on the strategic and tactical prosecution of the war. Prosecution, not the reasons for the war. Ariel Sharon in charge, you make a point in your book, took 2 years to plan Operation Peace in Galilee, in the 1982 invasion of Lebanon, to clear out the terrorism then. Would he have reacted with the same reliance on air power, for example? Would he have reacted at all to the same degree to the events of July 12th?
I think that it would be different, because Ariel Sharon is not acting with aviation, but he is a paratrooper. He is a general many years, and he can not to achieve this battlefield without results. And the result is to release our two soldiers. This is the final result, and this is the disappointment, because they not come back at home, the two soldiers. The other thing.
So in Israel, the issue of the soldiers is very important as Hezbollah rockets.
The barrage of 5,000 rockets from Katyusha to Haifa to the villages of the north, as one is continue after the ceasefire, and government Ehud Olmert as the chief of government. Go to war hastily.
Quickly. Yeah. Ambassador Eitan, hold your thoughts. We're going to come back right after the news. Montreal, and everybody listening on the World Wide Web, we're going to be spending most of the next hour with Ambassador Freddie Eitan, talking about his new biography of Ariel Sharon, A Life in Times of Turmoil, and his publisher, Robert Davies of Studio 9 Books. We'll be back after the news. Our very weekend in studio, Freddie Eitan, former Israeli ambassador and author of the new biography of Ariel Sharon, In Times of Turmoil, and the publisher, Robert Davies, of Studio 9 Books. And we're going to be talking, spending most of the next hour with both of them, talking with Ambassador Eitan about how the Middle East could have been different under Ariel Sharon, what made him write the book. And later on, we'll be talking to Robert Davies about how a Montreal publisher, and this certainly isn't his first venture, but competes on the world stage with this kind of an effort. Ambassador Eitan, welcome again. What led you to do this book at this time? As you said, it's not an authorized biography. It's more of investigative journalism, and you do journalism like I do. You advocate a position, and that's a good thing, in my view, for this book. But what led you to do it now?
I represent a project in Institute of Foreign Affairs and Public Affairs in Jerusalem. I am a director of a project about Europe and Israel. It's very important to us to explain not the official policy of the government, but especially to explain why Israel is right against terrorism, and to obtain finally a recognized borders. This is the two issues that we work now, and we expect from the European countries to change their policy. And when I heard a few minutes ago that Solana said about Iran,
Javier Solana,
the foreign minister of the UN, European Union, say that we can expect from Iran something about negotiation, about the threat of nuclear power, I can say that he is very naive to say about Iran, about the threat. And for Israel, it's very important to influence not also leader opinions, but also the media to change their mind about the threat today. The threat of Iran and the threat of the global terrorism.
Before the break, you had mentioned that if Ariel Sharon still led Israel, his prosecution of the war might have been different. Less of a reliance on air power, more infantry at the beginning. Would his approach on Iran be different? I think a lot of people were surprised when a week ago Israel just informed the world, the same day that Hassan Nasrallah made his apology, in quotes, that they had named General Ephraim Shkedny to head the Iranian front. Is that a normal move, if anything's normal in these times?
Yes, it's. You can say yes.
Would this be the way Ariel Sharon would send a message?
Ariel Sharon is different because not only his experience in military field, but his experience as a politician, I think that is a statesman. This is the difference between him and Ehud Olmert. Sharon is a statesman, and Ehud Olmert is a politician. He deal about his career, his own career. But Sharon, the deal, the great deal, is the future of our nation. How to live with our neighbors, but in hostile environment. And this is the issue. And I think that Sharon, about Iran, he talked with, as you know, with George Bush and the international. The threat of Iran is not a threat against only Israel. Is the threat against Europe.
And the whole West.
And the whole West.
We'll get into that just in 2 seconds, in a short break after we pay some bills. Get into that. Montreal, we'll be right back. The future of the Middle East and how it would have been different had Ariel Sharon still guests, our former Israeli MP Eitan, who's authored Sharon, A Life in Times of Turmoil, and his publisher, Robert Davies, of Studio 9 Books. Before the break, Ambassador Eitan, we were talking about how Iran poses a threat not only to Israel but the entire free world, and how and what is the difference between statesmanlike leadership and political leadership?
It is a lack of leadership in not only in Israel but I think that in the world against the threat of Iran. Iran, we can compare the threat before the Second World War. And exactly what Chamberlain and Daladier, the French, go to Munich in September 1938 and deal with the Satan Nazi. The result?
And dismember the Czech Republic.
Of course. And this is the problem. With Iran and with the threat, they not expect any compromise from them. Our language is directly because our enemies, as Iran and Hezbollah and Al-Qaeda, are cowards, ugly, and we must fight against this new wave of terrorism and anti-Semitism and anti-Zionist only by force. This is the language that Sharon adopted against the Palestinian and against the Hamas.
Your work, as you yourself said, it doesn't mean to be objective. You're an admirer of Sharon. I'm an admirer of Ariel Sharon. When you say that Sharon, the statesman versus Olmert or others as politicians, one of the criticisms that has been suggested about Olmert's leadership of this war is his reluctance to use infantry because that would have meant calling up more reserves, disrupting civilian life, and he sort of had one eye on the polls. Is there any legitimacy to that criticism, number one? And number two, would Ariel Sharon have had the same concerns?
Of course, the criticism is, you know, in Israel you have now not only demonstrators and the inquiry against what happened exactly before the war, in the war, and after the war. And the criticism against Ehud Olmert is justified. And maybe one in another leader in Israel or in the world, after the fiasco of this war, maybe resign. Honestly. Sharon, you mentioned that he prepared the first war in 1982, 2 years, during 2 years. And he if he was now in leading the new war against Lebanon, he would prepare it. And Sharon was burned after the first war in Lebanon, and I think that Sharon will not lead or go to the war in two fronts simultaneously,
even three fronts.
Well, three fronts in the West Bank.
Right. You were very close to Prime Minister Sharon. You were with him at many important moments, including Beirut. There has been a suggestion. There's been historians have talked about this, that when it came at the time of the decisive bombing of Beirut that finally pushed the PLO out, there was some discussion between the Prime Minister Begin at the time and General Sharon about going into Beirut, and despite General Sharon's reputation for toughness and roughness and giving no quarter, there's a suggestion by historians that it was actually General Sharon who said to the Prime Minister, we're not going into the streets because we're not going to lose 3,000 young boys fighting for the streets of Beirut.
Right.
So he had that in his mind.
Yeah, of course.
Constantly.
Of course. And we accuse, the Palestinians had accused, and the world, the opinion of the world, and particularly the Belgian, as you know, the Belgian... wanted to judge Mr. Sharon after the Savage Chechila massacre. But as you know, the Falangists, the Christians, killed the Palestinians. And Sharon ordered not to go. But I think that Sharon, it's a mistake that Sharon did not exactly commence after the troops, after IDF troops evacuate after the assassination of Gemayel, not evaluate that revenge of the Falangists will be so cruel against the Palestinian.
Many people thought that the Commission of Inquiry in Israel,
the
Kahn Commission, that said that, well, he didn't know, but maybe he should have known, was kind of politically harsh, was harsh on General Sharon, general at the time, and politically motivated. How much did that affect him personally?
Very. All many years, he continued to suffer after this judgment of allegations about this commission, Kahn. And this commission, as you know, he resigned from the Ministry of Defense. And many years, he was an outsider in the politics, in the arena of politics in Israel.
To me, that was a very telling time, because he had every right to be bitter. He knew that part of this was a politically motivated investigation. And yet, I can't remember him vociferously speaking out against the government. He sort of understood the realpolitik, and despite the injustice of it, just went on his way for a few years.
Exactly, exactly. But he was in bitterness, really, and he thought that at that time, when the Israeli go to war, there is not any opposition of this operation. And you remember that in Tel Aviv, the demonstrators are from the opposition, the Labour Party, against Begin and Ariel Sharon. They call him assassin.
Ambassador Eitan, Robert Davis will be right back after this short break. With two former Israelis, author of Sharon, Times of Turmoil, a new biography of Ariel Sharon, and his publisher, Robert Davis, of Studio 9 Books of Montreal, about how a Canadian publisher competes on a world level with a world product. Ambassador Eitan, before the break, we were talking about how Ariel Sharon handled himself in a statesmanlike manner after the commissions of inquiry, after the 1982 Lebanese War, but he also did things in a statesmanlike manner that perhaps only he could have done in the past several years before his stroke in terms of peacemaking, including the unilateral withdrawal from Gaza that nobody else, perhaps on the Israeli political scene, had the authenticity or the legitimacy to do without any opposition.
Right. I think that only Sharon could be the man in the right place and in this situation, in these circumstances, that we can, one, to decide to withdraw from Gaza and maybe to decide a pull out from the West Bank.
How would that have been the next step? I remember Clark Clifford saying to Lyndon Johnson in 1968, Lyndon, declare victory in Vietnam and get out. Would that have been Ariel Sharon's next step, to declare victory in the West Bank and except for certain towns like Ariel, Ma'ale Adumim, Efrat, and the Gush Etzion block, would have just, you know, said, okay, you know, Barack offered you 99.9% of the West Bank at Camp David. Take it. We're out of here.
Yes. You remember that Sharon was in the White House, and he discussed with President Bush in April 2004, and President Bush gave him a letter. It is the first letter that the President of America sent to the government of Israel that said, we, United States, guarantee that Israel will be tomorrow with defensible borders. And for us, it's very important not only to achieve what we expect, because as you know, we are the only nation in the world without recognized and defensible borders. We are also...
Some are recognized, but they're not defensible. So they'll give Israel a 7-kilometer neck, but that's about it.
Well, but it also was the only nation that our capital, Jerusalem, D.C., was not recognized
right.
by any country, including Canada, including United States. Jerusalem is our country since King David.
It's your capital.
The capital. And it's a capital for peace, a capital with brotherhood, with Christians and Muslims. This is very important to us to recognize that finally the state of Israel will be in peace, but also as a with own capital and own recognized borders.
Robert Davies.
Beryl Weissman.
Studio 9 Books. You're by no means an unknown quality in publishing. You published Esther DeLille's Traitor and the Jew.
I did.
You've published Prime Minister Trudeau's last book on Charlottetown.
I have.
How did this marriage between you and Ambassador Eitan come about, and how did you get in your head that you're going to take an international product and publish it out of Montreal and sell it all over the world?
Well, I've been publishing international products for 40 years in English, and before that only in French. I can spot a good book when I see one. I believe the role of a publisher, my role, is to give... legitimacy and distribution to interesting stories and interesting voices. And I've never described myself as a Canadian publisher. I believe that books should be written, published, distributed, and read because they're good and not because of where they come from.
How different is that from most Canadian publishers? It's not just that Canadians have a reluctance to compete internationally, but it's almost, there's this national mindset, and you and I have talked about this, of navel-gazing, and what does it mean to be a Canadian, and that's how we should publish books about the walruses and God knows what. And you've said nonsense to this.
I don't want to...
And more power to you for doing it, but...
Thank you.
It took guts.
Well, I don't want to dump on my fellow Canadian publishers. Everyone has the right and the... I think the opportunity to define what they do in life. My definition of my role is not a nationalist role. Stories are international. There are some good Canadian stories, and there are a lot of boring Canadian stories, too. Should all of the boring stories be published? Maybe not. Maybe too many were published, and that's why a lot of Canadian books don't sell anymore, because the Canadian reading public, not being particularly stupid, figured out finally that it wasn't a great idea to spend money on books that they didn't really want to read. But to get back to this particular book, I was in Paris buying lunch to an old friend of mine, and he had just published that very day the French version of Ambassador Etain's book. When I saw it, I immediately recognized that it had a lot of potential in the English-speaking world.
Robert Davies, hold on to that thought. We're going to go on to discuss how this marriage happened right after the news break, and some more bills are going to be paid.
Like a life boy.
Okay. Guests tonight are the new Ariel Sharon biography, A Life in Times of Turmoil, and Robert Davies, Studio 9 Books, and Robert Davies Publishing, the Canadian publisher of this very well-received book on the world stage. And Robert Chitticone of Associated Press in Paris calls it a remarkable piece of investigative journalism. And Diplomacy Magazine says, read this book. And Robert Davies, before the break, you were telling us how this marriage happened and how Canadians shouldn't be afraid to compete on the world stage as publishers.
Well, anybody can compete in the world stage. You're competing in the world stage in radio. In fact, the technology has made it possible to be on the world stage in a much easier
but,
more
but
way
so
than
much
30
of Canadian
years ago.
Publishing has contracted in the past 5 years. It's scaring independent publishers when they see houses like McClelland and Stewart close down and large American houses take over what were Canadian houses.
Well, that's true. That's true. But you can easily make the argument that the whole Canadian publishing, small publishing scene was created for political reasons by the federal government to enable a vision of Canada and a definition of Canada in terms of cultural creation, creativity. But it didn't really stand on much. And in the end, McClelland Stewart in Toronto and other Canadian publishers, general distribution, general publishing, they went up in smoke, the biggest bankruptcy in the history of Canadian culture. What's left is the very small, for the most part, and defined as Canadian sector, which has more and more problems as time goes on, simply because the taste of the Canadian reading public is really international. It's not Canadian in the sense that if you live in Alberta, you're going to be all hot to trot about a book touting the life in small town New Brunswick. But that's a problem with the entire country.
You found out about this book how? How did you, Ambassador Etain, meet, or how did you? What came first, the chicken or the egg? Did you meet the ambassador, or did you hear about the book?
I guess the egg came first. I saw the book in French, published by this pal of mine in Paris. We had
and
nice
the French title is called Le Bras de Fer?
Le Bras de Fer, the Iron Arm.
Yeah.
And when I saw it, I thought it would do very well in English, on condition that we could get it out very quickly, because sometimes in history, unusual events happen. Ariel Sharon's stroke was the event that gave him a lot more potential interest. Because other books have appeared on Ariel Sharon. Some of the big American publishers did books 4 or 5 years ago, and they were not big successes.
But what I like about this book is that it's a good read.
It's a very good read. It's a good story. The subject is lying in between life and death after a stroke. And people,
Robert, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Our producer's about to have a stroke. We're going to have to go to traffic for a short break, and we'll be right back.
There's no traffic at this time of night.
I keep telling them that. Montreal will be back.
Let's have some fun.
Come on. I did. Rise, President of Studio 9 Books, before the break, and how this book came to be, and you met the publisher, was a friend of yours.
I did. The French publisher has been a friend of mine for about 5 years. He had actually published an interesting book on Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden and was doing a second book called The Plot to Destroy the West, which I was considering doing, but other circumstances made it impossible for me to do that. And when I saw this book, I was interested right away. And it happened by accident that the Ambassador Etain was in Paris that very week. So we had breakfast the next morning. Very long and interesting breakfast. Ambassador Etain is an extremely charming and knowledgeable man. I learned that he had already published 10 or 11 books. He knows how to write a book. He knows a good story when he sees one to tell. And I know a good story when I hear one to publish.
Somebody said about him that he sweats ink?
Someone said he sweats ink, and he's a prolific author. And he's a good author. He's a good journalist. He knows he worked for years in Paris as a correspondent for Israeli radio. He is certainly worthwhile giving voice to on the world scene. As it happens, I was in a position to be able to do that. the books I publish are well distributed in English all over the world.
And you translated this book also.
I did. We had considered doing the translation in Israel, and I finally realized that for this book to be successful, it had to be published quickly. I'm a quick translator, and I think a pretty good translator. And so I did it myself, with no support from the Canada Council for the Arts. I think we were probably in the Guinness Book of World of Records because a book that appeared in Paris in late February and appears in English 4.5 months later, and it's not a 25-page book, it's almost 400 pages, that's almost unknown in the annals of publishing.
And you're organizing, and you've organized, a book tour for the ambassador. Ambassador, you'll be going at Montreal, Toronto, New York, Robert?
Philadelphia, Chicago. New Jersey, Chicago, and San Antonio, Texas.
Where can people get information on the book tour?
People, it's a good point. People can go to our website and look at the places where the ambassador will be touring.
What's the website address?
Studio9.bz.
Studio9.bz. Is that nine or, with a number?
With a number. Or if you're in the United States, 9.bz. If you're in the U.S., Studio9.bz. He has one day in Philadelphia and one day in San Antonio and one day in New York. And if it's tomorrow, it's Brussels. And if it's Tuesday, it's Taiwan. It's a very fast tour. Ambassador Eitan wanted to be back home for Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish holiday. He may come back to North America in November. We'll see what his time schedule is and what our abilities are. But certainly I can tell you this. We could have kept him on the road for 6 months. And he wouldn't have had a day's peace because we had requests for him from California to Maine and from Florida up to Alaska.
Now this Wednesday, there's a major event this Wednesday night in Montreal.
On Wednesday, he's speaking at 4100 Sherbrooke Street West. That's the Temple Emmanuel Beth Shalom. It's a free public lecture. It starts at 7:30. It's a book launch. He'll be speaking for a limited amount of time, followed by an open question and answer period, which will be also limited in time because we're expecting a big crowd and people will want him to sign their books and leave with something of value that they can add to their libraries. Afterwards, he'll be in Toronto doing the same thing and then on the road all over the place.
Now, Robert Davies, after what you've done with an international property, after what you've done with the translation, you're going to have a whole host of energetic young Canadian authors calling you, if they're not calling you already, and saying, I've got a great book. What do you say to them?
Good for you.
That's what you're going to say to them.
It's not my responsibility to publish everything that comes my way.
Ambassador Eitan, Bob Davies said a few moments ago that sometimes things happen in a way that's in a timing that's almost destined. The Prime Minister's stroke was the French version of the book was already published, or you were just getting it out at the time?
No, I had a chapter after the stroke. I can tell you that Robert Davies did a tremendous job in a few months. He translated and he published this book. The originality of this book is that the reader can compare the leadership between Ariel Sharon and Ehud Olmert.
But in many ways, it's a primer of leadership for statesmen anywhere.
No, of course, but we added two chapters after the election of Olmert and after the election also of Amir Peretz as the Minister of Defense. And I think with documents.
In the English edition.
In English, yeah. 100 pages of documents and 30 illustrations, reader can do the best. Because if you not read this book, you can understand what has happened today. And historical documents is very important to more comprehensive and also to understand what is going on in our region. And this is very important.
Ambassador, your publishers are trying to get a word in edgewise.
Let me just say this. I follow the international scene. I consider myself politically aware. And I realized as I was translating this book that my image of Ariel Sharon, my understanding of who he was based on a lot of cliches and not much real understanding, not much real information. I learned an awful lot about Ariel Sharon by reading Freddie Etan's book. That's the proof that the book is well-researched and put together in an interesting way. The story of Ariel Sharon, some people have said, intertwines very closely with the story of Israel. And Sharon, who has been called a lot of names and demonized by a lot of people, turns out to be a very complex personality who was faced with difficult choices, as we all are in life, and did things which, in many ways, saved his country.
Yes.
And certainly he deserves to be understood. He is an important person on the world scene. And this book, which is the first book to appear since he was laid low by his stroke, is an opportunity for readers all over the world to understand the man more and to go beyond the cliché that the world media has been showing him as. It's an opportunity that I thought was great for me, and I think a lot of people are going to think the same thing.
Yes, many readers.
Ambassador Robert Davies will be right back after this short break. And we're finishing up our hour with Ambassador Freddie Etan, the author of a brilliant new biography of Ariel Sharon, A Life in Times of Turmoil. I recommend it to everyone. This is journalist and publisher, president of Studio 9 Books. This changed people's minds on things, hasn't it? On the subject.
Yes, many readers, after read the book in French and now in English, say to me that they change their mind about Ariel Sharon. They diabolize Ariel Sharon.
They demonize them.
Yes. I think that they change now their opinion, not only about his policy, but they regret sincerely what they said in the past about Ariel Sharon and about Sabra Chatila and about many events in the Middle East in the three decades.
I think it needs hardly be said that image sometimes replaces reality. Mm-hmm. And much of what we've seen in Quebec, even had the war been prosecuted, even had Ariel Sharon prosecuted a war against Lebanon, I think the language, the words would have been different about Israel. And I think part of that is that the man was held in great respect, and the man got across one important message, that you cannot rely, as much of Quebec media has relied, on the old canard that I am an anti-Zionist and not an anti-Semite. Because if there was ever a living embodiment of the truth, that those two cannot be separated. And the passionate exponent who got that image across, it was Ariel Sharon. Mm. And when one recalls the words of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. in his speech at Harvard in 1968, when he said, "And what is anti-Zionism? It is the denial to the Jewish people of a fundamental right that we justly claim for the people of Africa and freely accord all other nations of the globe. It is discrimination against Jews because they are Jews. In short, it is anti-Semitism." And Ariel Sharon was one of the few people who could get that message across in a universal context. Ambassador Freddie Etan, publisher Robert Davies, we thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Beryl. Great pleasure to be here.
Montreal and everybody who's listening on the World Wide Web, we'll be back tomorrow night, and we're devoting the whole show to an examination of the visit to America of Iranian ex-president Mohammad Khatami. And this man was president of Iran at the time that Montreal photojournalist Zahra Khazami was tortured to death, at the time that others were tortured to death. We'll have a full hour of examination on this, from lawyers working on these cases in London to the members of the victims' families. And one of the family members that we'll be interviewing is a young lady named Nazreen Mohammadi, whose brother Akbar was killed in an Iranian prison last month. The prosecutor of Akbar Mohammadi was the same Saeed Murtazavi who was named as the prosecutor of Zahra Khazami, and having been responsible for her torture and her death, the same Zayed Murtazavi who was named prosecutor general of Iran by Mohammad Khatami, the same Zayed Murtazavi who the government of Stephen Harper, and I'm proud to say this, that Canada has led in this, called for his arrest. And it'll be a very dramatic program tomorrow night, and before we go, I want to read you a brief poem from the prison diary of Akbar Mohammadi, the student leader who was killed, tortured, at one point having his mouth glued shut. And he wrote a poem called In the Pitch of the Night. It is some time now that in this solitude silence is the color on the lips, a far cry away calls me, but my feet are bound in the dark of the night. There is no hope in the darkness. All doors and walls are closed in. If a shadow slithers on the ground, it is only an illusion in sight. People's breathing is depressed. It is some time now that in this despair, all joy is gone. The spell of the night closes on me and my sorrow. I try hard, but it laughs at me. Whatever effort I made in the day went up the smoke when night came along. The drawings I made at night are nowhere to be found. It's been a while now that I, like others, see only silence on the lips. There is no movement in this darkness. My hands and feet are bound in the pitch of the night. And as all of you watch the proceedings of Muhammad Khatami and the treatment he receives and the words of nullification and interposition that drip from his lips, think of Akbar Mohammadi. Think of Zahra Khazemi, tortured alone in dark, cold cells in Iran. Thank you to Chris Smith, Chris Bunbury, Master Control, Professor Freddie Eitan, Robert Davies. Thank you again. We'll be back with you tomorrow night.